D72 is the professional PC text multi-tool designed for automation in diagnostic, Windows repair, and malware removal. No other tool can help you automate more, relax more, and get paid with less effort than ever. Podnuts likes to thank Nick Shaw for his continued support.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Geeksters episode 120. My name is Martin Obando. I'm one of the co-hosts here. Geeksters is a show where we just talk about anything geekery, from phones to Linux to desktops to cloud storage, servers. I cover everything, Mitch.
And anything else, yes.
And anything else. And that, of course, is my co-host for the day, Mitch Heyman.
Hello, hello, hello.
How's it going, Mitch?
Not too bad. HTC One M8.
Little
case for it. And so far, so good. I'm not complaining about it. I haven't put any, just a few apps on it. But it's fast. I mean, very responsive. Well, so, so were my other Androids when I first got them.
Well, yeah. But so you've had it for about a week?
A week today.
Is that why we didn't have you on the show last week? You were out playing hooky?
Well, let me think. No, I did have a doctor's appointment. Actually, I did. I barely got home. I got home like 6:30, 6:40, and then it was just too much rushing.
Then you got your new phone, and it's like, the phone wins. No, I completely understand, Mitch. No. We missed you last week. I don't know if you've heard last week's episode. We had Brian Lunduke on. And so if anybody hasn't heard last week's episode, that's 119. I interviewed Brian Lunduke, and he kind of interviewed me, and we just kind of sat around and chatted. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. I started listened to most of it until the video started messing up for whatever reason.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, from YouTube or something.
Oh, well, I can't control that. But yeah, the audio is good.
Yeah, yeah, I didn't listen to the audio. But I was listening to some of his other stuff because he was on that Linux Action Show, which is I've listened to it before. It's a pretty good production, Linux show. I haven't listened to it in a while, but I didn't know he was on there.
Yeah, him and... Is it Chris? I haven't listened to it very much.
I forget Chris, and I forgot the other guy's name.
Well, the other gentleman that's been on there the longest time, I think they started, or Brian Lunduke started, the Jupiter Broadcasting Network, mm-hmm. which is that. So, yeah, he kind of helped get that whole thing going.
It was good. But I was listening to some of his stuff, and he was going, "Why Linux Sucks," or something. I don't know.
Yeah, he does a show called Why Linux Sucks, and then follows it up with Why Linux Doesn't Suck.
Yeah, I'm just getting ticked off. Let me tell you real quick my problem.
Sure. Go ahead.
Not that it's a problem. Getting Oracle Java installed. I know that you can use that OpenSore or the Iced Tea, but for whatever reason, it doesn't work. So I have to put Java on, at least on this one site that I go to. I've gone to it for years. So it's working fine in Firefox, and it was working I had Chrome on there. And it was working there at one time, but then I did some updates, and it's not working in Chrome anymore. It's still working in Firefox. So I'm just playing around with it, doing whatever he says, and symbiotic links, and nothing's working. So I took Chrome off, put Chromium on, and I did install something else, and at least it's showing in the plugins in Chromium now. It wasn't showing before, but it's still working in Firefox, so that's where I left off. It's not a big deal, but big enough.
Well, Chrome comes with their own version of Java, and I believe it's called Pepper or Succotash or...
Yeah, but not... It's different on Linux. It doesn't work.
Right. No, you're absolutely correct. And I have one of the things that I do when I install Chrome, because I use Chrome, is I have a mm-hmm. script that I run that purges OpenJDK and then adds a repository from the web update team mm-hmm. and then does an update, and then it installs the Oracle Java 7. So I will put that in the show notes, and I'll send it to you. I'll put it in our chat here real quick, Mitch. But this is what you would run is that.
But let me see.
Yeah. So I'll put in the show notes, so if anybody wants to know, the top line, I have it in a text file, and I can run it as a script. So the top one says echo Java. Yeah, that means it's just going to do that. No, just everything after that, the sudo and then stuff.
Let me copy it.
Yeah, and I'll throw that in the installer. And this is what I've always done for mine, because it removes everything Java that came with it and then reinstalls it with a new fresh one. And I will definitely put that in the show notes for other people who are using.
That uninstalls the old version?
Yes.
It does? Okay.
Yes. And I'll put it in the show notes for anybody using at least a new. I know it works in Ubuntu, so it uses sudo apt-get, so it's a Debian-based tool. So if you're using Linux Mint, Debian, Java, I'm sorry, Ubuntu or any of the other flavors of Debian-based distros, go ahead and run this. If you have issues with Java, it's something I've always done, and then you can just, after it does this, then go ahead and do another update because it should update some more after that, and then it always keeps me up to date.
So I don't have to take off what's on there already?
No, just because the first one will do the purge. So what it does is it says sudo apt-get purge openjdk with a star. It purges all everything, and then it adds a repository. It does an update. You add to do an update, and then a sudo apt-get install oracle dash java 7 dash installer, and that will it has worked for me in the past. Because Screen Connect, which I've talked about before on here as my remote management tool, uses Java on the Linux base. So Linux and Mac uses Java. Windows uses .NET. So if you're going from Windows to Windows, it'll use the .NET. But I have to use Java because it's Linux based. And so far, I haven't had any issues with that, running that particular one. So give that a try.
I'll try if I didn't do it already. But like I said, it's working fine in Firefox. Just I can't figure out why it just stopped working in Chrome. It worked in there once. So
Chrome has their own version, and I believe that's what's causing a lot of that.
Okay.
Well, Mitch, it has come back around. Today is Patch Tuesday.
Oh, yeah.
And today, actually, this is what I found. And actually, this is from Naked Security, from Sophos. I think it's funny. And their title of this article is Patch Tuesday for June 2014. 7 bulletins, 3 CREs, 2 criticals, and 1 funky sort of hole. and I thought, well, that'll catch my attention. So, of course, you have, it says, it says this. 7 bulletins, 3 remote code executions, those are the RCEs. Patches apply to Windows, Internet Explorer, Office, Live Meeting, and Lynx. Lynx is the enterprise version of their messaging application. So inside of corporate offices, you can run that. All supported versions of IE get patches. All versions of Windows, including Server, Core, and RT, get at least 1 critical remote code execution patch. And all patch systems need to be rebooted. Even more briefly, it says even more briefly, you need to patch and reboot every Windows system on your network. Okay, except for your Windows XP computers. But why not reboot them in solidarity anyways? One of the one where they said the funky hole is because there's one called tampering. And it says that you don't see a lot of tampering, apparently. So tampering is a vulnerability that may or may not give you a notice that it has done something. So it actually says... Let's see, for example, tampering explained. Tampering is another sort of security hole that may help the crooks either by allowing them to initiate their attack more easily or by making things worse once you have broken in. Very loosely, tampering means you can make a security-related change that should raise an alarm but doesn't. So, if you are running Windows, it's Patch Tuesday, run your updates. And it affects a lot of systems and a lot of stuff, especially IE. But I didn't mean to jump into the news right away because I wanted to talk to you about some of the stuff that I had did over the weekend. So I just got back from California. I spent the last four days there. I was there Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then got back last night. I'll actually be heading down to California again next Monday, farther though, and I'll be flying this time. I deployed a new server 2012 down there, and I have never, first time I've had a server 2012. And really, the more I played with it, the more I liked it. I really found it pretty easy to use. It does have the little Metro interface, or the tiled interface, but it's very stripped out. It's not kind of what you would normally see in Windows 8. So it does have the little 8, almost like the 8.1 start menu down the bottom that will drop you out to the desktop. So it kind of toggles back and forth. The desktop is nice, clean, tidy. There is not a start menu or a start button that brings up a list of stuff. So it does have that search feature where you just start typing and everything. Mm-hmm. Had to find out where some things were. I added another hard drive to the machine because it had two drives in a RAID. But we were noticing some performance issues with it, especially SQL, an SQL database. So we purchased a 256 gig solid state drive. I added that to the machine as just a standalone drive, but couldn't figure out where to add it. I was looking for that computer management, and I found it. Found it listed there. And then, once you found out where the applications were, because I knew what I was looking for, and then it was all really simple. And so by the time I kind of was ready to deploy it after I had it in my house for 4 days, I believe, kind of on and off doing Windows updates, kind of looking at it, messing with it, and letting another tech in from the company that will be running their proprietary application on it. I kind of got used to it, and really that nervousness that I felt going from 2008 to 2012, because it went away. I didn't fear 2012 as much anymore.
So basically, it was the same. You just had to find where the configurations were.
Oh. Right. So it's not like going from, because my biggest concern was going from 7 to 8, where it's a completely new thing. I'm totally lost. I don't have a clue where to go stuff. And I think being able to use Windows 8 at least a little bit, you may not like it, but at least using it kind of gave me a better understanding of how 2012 works and how you could just start typing things into it with search. And so there are some cool things that does, but you know, unlike Windows 8, there is one Internet Explorer. There's one way to do this. There's one way to do that. Whereas the difference between 8 and the 2012 and a server is that there's, you know, you have your tablet interface and then you have your desktop interface. And, you know, but I liked it. And I think I will be deploying out another one of them to, I have another site that has a 2003 server, which is going to be going away. So support for that ends in a year. And I'm going to be deploying, I'm seriously considering a 2012 server as opposed to 2008. The only drawback is that 2012 server licensing is more of an a la carte style, where with 2008 or 2, you get 5 CALs that comes with the operating system, where 2012 you don't. So it can be more expensive because of the a la carte style.
It's all about license.
Yeah, the licensing, okay. the client access licensing. Okay. So I was down there. It's a veterinary office, and you know, it gets dirty, and we've been having issues with our primary server, where it'll be working, and then I'll get a call from them because their credit card processing application will stop working, and what'll happen is they can access the application, but it doesn't go out to the internet. It requires internet access to get out, so I make a connection to the server through either Screen Connect and or remote terminal services. And I can make a connection, so I know it's getting internet access, but it's not resolving any web pages. So DNS is kind of acting kind of weird. And I would reboot the server, and it would be fine. Or every now and then, it would just stop responding. I couldn't do anything. They'd have to go back. They'd have to hold the power button in, shut it down. They'd turn it back on. It would take a long time to come back up. It wouldn't be responding. They'd do it again. They'd wait even longer, and then it would finally come back up. And I knew this was happening, and I knew I was going down, so we were just kind of babying it until I could get down there to take a look at it. Well, I got done blowing out all the other desktops because they were really dirty. And I wanted to give the server some time to do its thing and everything to calm down and let the gentleman who was doing the database move get all that stuff done. So I was just working on the desktops. And so that afternoon, I took the server offline and I went ahead and took it outside and brought my little blower with me. I use a tent, like it's an Ozark. One for like you can get it like Fred Meyer's or Walmart, or I think it's Target actually, where you plug it in the wall and it has the big blower on it. So for like air mattresses, that's the one that I use. It's great. It's not canned air. It actually has quite a bit of force to it. It is electrical, but if you're next to an electrical outlet, you can do that. If I really don't have one, I think I have a tent one that takes like the 4D batteries or 4C batteries, you know, like for camping. Mm-hmm. Those work too. I don't have an air compressor, and a lot of times those spin up. The bad thing about those is that it's so powerful that if you hit the fans wrong, you could possibly damage the fans because you're spinning it so fast.
Right.
So this one actually works out quite well. Took the side off, started blowing things off, right? You know, kind of was just making a sweeping motion. I hit the CPU fan and it didn't move.
It didn't what?
It did not move.
Really?
So I spun it with my fingers and it kind of moved. But it's the, oh no, the bearings are bad on this fan. You know, it was actually really, really shot. Now, when I travel to this small coastal town of, it's really 3,000 people, 5,000 if you count Pelican Bay State Prison, which is the prison there. There is hardly anything there. You know, I can probably go to Radio Shack or to Walmart and get a switch or some kind of a router or something like that. But really, SATA cables... I can get Ethernet cables there, but of course you're going to pay an arm and a leg for those, but
heat sink and fan.
No heat sink and fan. So I asked my friend if he would come over because really I know all the techs who work there because I've grown up there. If the techs that have been there, or at least the techs that I know, I've either worked with or been friends with, or we've, you know, or worked under. And actually at this time, the gentleman that actually works there, his name is George. He is, we graduated the same year high school. So we went through eighth grade together. He actually landed a job working for the court system. They needed an employee. I came. So he was actually my boss for a while. And then we worked alongside each other for in another capacity. And now we're colleagues. And I got a hold of him and asked if he would come look at it and see if he had any old parts just laying around, because we could go with a definite used one. This was an Intel motherboard, a socket 755, as a Core 2 Duo, and the heatsink was one that it didn't clamp onto the motherboard. It had four prongs on each side of it, that and then it had a backing plate that had screws in it. So these screws screwed into the backing plate. So it was I knew that it was probably going to be a very lucky find if I even found it at all. So he came over and he looked at it and he's like, "Well," so we took the heatsink off and looked at the heatsink and we were trying to look at it and trying to spin it a little bit. And then we thought, well, what if we but pull the screws out, because there's long screws, but the screws are held in by by a pin. Mm-hmm. And if you try to move the pin because it's set in there, then it starts to bend. And it just wasn't working out right. And I thought, well, what if I snip the fan, the wings on inside the fan? I take another fan and I put it either catty corner to it or something like that, and then use zip ties to hold the fan on. Now, this is not a permanent solution, but temporary. I knew that I was not going to be able to find this heatsink fan combo in this small town. And so we kind of thought about that and was like, well, you know, let me call another town. And so the closest town that would probably have this is a little town or a bigger town called Grants Pass, Oregon. And really, it's an hour and a half by car away through a remote canyon. It's the way I came down. And it's just windy roads, and it's a fun drive, but it's an hour and a half away. And so I called, and a gentleman answered the phone on a Saturday. He was supposed to be closed, but he answered the phone, which was very nice. And yeah, he had one, and he was going to sell it to me for $20. And I asked him, I just said $20, and he says, okay. He says, fine, I'll do it for $15. And I said, oh no, I'm not paying for this. It's a client of mine. And he goes, okay, fine, it's back to $20. I said, all right. I said, I'm going to go look at some other parts because we hadn't made it to my friend's office yet. And I said, I'll give you a call back when I'm on my way, because he was going to hold on to it for me, meet him at a shop. I'm not sure what, but I was going to have to drive now, you know, 3 hours, possibly, you know, three and a half hours round trip for a $20 part. So we took off to my friend's shop, rummaged through his stuff. He didn't have one. There was one last location on the way out of town, and it's this little place called Chuck's PC World. It's just this little shop, and it's fairly new. My friend has never been in there. I've never been in there. I have no idea what they carry, what they hold, nothing, not a clue. But it's on my way out of town. So I pull in there, and they say, what can I help you with? And I said, I need this part. And I have the whole processor or the CPU, you know, the heatsink and fan. And he goes, let me look. And he's looking through his cabinet, and he opens up a box, and it's exactly the same. It's not a MOS, it's not a MASCOOL, but it's a Thermaltake, but it's exactly the same structure, the four pins, it's got the backing plate, everything. He had one for $25.99 plus tax. So I spent $31.78, and I saved myself 4 hours, you know, three and a half hours worth of driving.
Yeah.
And was able to replace the part. And I thought, oh my gosh, I thought for sure there was just, if you would have said, you know, bet money that he didn't, that he had this part, I would have said no. And I would have taken whatever, you know, I would have thrown it completely out the window and said, there is no way that he's got this part. Because really, I have to carry SATA cables and Molex connectors and any remote thing that I possibly want that's not a DVD or a CD pack or anything like Walmart doesn't carry. But you don't think
about a heatsink and fan.
There's no way I would carry a heatsink and fan for a 7-year-old system.
Right. So was it a server, did you say? Or
it was a server. It was a primary domain controller.
It's probably from running 24/7. They just
It was definitely from running, but it was just like, I can't not leave this. I mean, I have to fix this problem. And that's why I was thinking, if it means that I have to drive to Grants Pass, and if they don't have it, then on to Medford, which is another 40 minutes outside of Grants Pass, I have to get this fixed. But I was able to just come back, screw it all in, plug it in, turn it on, and away it went.
That's what I'm on my Linux machines. That's what that is. Pretty sure it's a 755. It's a Core 2 Quad.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good machine, actually. It's a real good machine, but it's just older now.
Right, but I mean, I can go to, you know, ENU, which is a local shop. You go on a Micro, which is a local shop. I can be to Fry's and back in 45 minutes. There is nothing like there. So I don't have the luxury of just saying, oh, okay, no problem. When I noticed that it was not working, I thought this is going to be a long haul because I just had gotten done talking to my parents because every time I go down, there's usually something else going on. I'm always busy working, and so I don't get a chance to visit with my in-laws very much because I'm always working. And so I went down and they said, well, what are your plans this weekend? I said, well, I'm going to deploy this server, but they're going to do stuff remotely. It's not a domain controller, so it's just a data server. They're going to move all the data. You know, really, it's going to be I worked quite a bit Friday night, a little bit on Saturday. Sunday was going to be flexible, and then a little bit on Monday, and then I'll head home. So in the grand scheme of things, of times that I've worked before, I'm going to be able to just relax at my hometown, you know, visit some friends that I've known from high school, go to the beach, you know, and just have fun. And when I saw the fan not spin, I thought, well, there goes that plan. there's always something. Got it fixed and was able to actually play a round of disc golf with my brother-in-law, 24 holes, in probably 30 to 40 mile an hour winds.
Wow.
Yeah. We lost a frisbee in the ocean, had some fun, you know, we had a good time, but man, I got back and I was pretty tired from bitten, hit by wind and salt water and, you know, kind of wandering around a golf course. And I've never played 24 holes before, especially into the wind. You kind of threw the frisbee on the ground in front of you because that's how you could get it into headwinds. But that was a lot of fun. That was my weekend. We, you know, deploying some new servers and learning about 2012 and then fixing a product that I didn't really think I was going to ever have the parts for.
It's just all quiet for me. That guy that I upgraded his XP machine to Windows 7 and put VirtualBox on there, with XP, so he can install XP. His old apps are working fine in there. And the only problem he had was... he's got Myworldbytes on her, you know, the free version. Mm-hmm. I guess from doing the updates, it updated to the newer one, to the 2.0. So he thought he had to pay for it. I said, nah, you'll still be, because I logged it in. Nah, you see, you just have to do the manual scans. Like, it's got a different interface, you know, the version 2.0, whatever. And right. So see, those other things are disabled, but it's still going to let you update. It's going to let you scan it. So just go ahead and do that. So that's the only thing he called me about. He's really, really happy.
Nice. So I've got a question for you then, because I've got a computer, not the one that's normally that you sit there, but you can kind of see the corner of a laptop behind me. That computer is running Windows XP. It has a virus on it. We're going to clean it up. But this gentleman runs a very old DOS program on there. It's when he had it owned his business. He's got a lot of archive data on there, but it is DOS. It actually opens up a DOS prompt and runs that way. So because it's a Windows XP machine, he knows he needs to buy a new computer. Would you recommend actually running VirtualBox, because that's a computer within a computer, essentially, or would you recommend moving it over and see if we can run it in compatibility mode?
You can try. You mean on Windows 7 on a new machine?
Yeah.
Well, you don't know until you try. But that being, I mean, this machine, I mean this what do you call it? The not a Photoshop type of program, but you know, a card suite program that they couldn't run in Windows 7. We tried everything. It would not. Well, we had 64-bit one there, and it wouldn't run. And maybe if it was a 32-bit install, it might have worked. But we tried all kinds of compatibility mode things, and it did not work. It's one of those, like, broader bond type suites, broader bond. And it just would not work in Windows 7.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that he had mentioned was buying a new machine, moving over all of his documents and Outlook and all that kind of stuff, but then using this old machine just solely offline, just solely for access to this one DOS program. And that's what he would keep it for.
Do that.
That's what he's going to do. Now, when I hand this machine back to him, because it is Windows XP and the support has gone away, I'm going to remove him as administrator because I have it because it installed some kind of fake antivirus program. I'm going to remove him as administrator, create him as a standard user, and then put a password on his administrator account. And go that route. And hopefully what it'll do is it will then prompt him whenever weird things get installed. I've worked on this computer before, probably like clockwork every 2 months. So even when Windows XP was getting support, he's got a tendency to get infected. Not huge, but every time he gets infected, it's another chance for it to be crypto-locked.
So you will get a new machine for him and make a standard user for him.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's the way they go.
Yeah, I'll just take his account and make it a standard user and then put CryptoLocker on it. Because one of these days, I just know one of these days he's going to lose his data on there.
I had a question about CryptoLocker.
Yeah.
Now, do you manually set that up?
I do it. There's two ways I've done it. Mm-hmm. Manually, if they do not have an Active Directory. I did confirm this with Nick Shaw. There are registry entries or changes you can, group policy changes you can make on a domain that will basically emulate the same thing that when you get CryptoPrevent from Nick Shaw and you run it, it makes policy changes, local group policy changes on the local machine. But I can do the same thing from a domain standpoint and push out all of those changes to one computer, to all the computers from one location. So, yes.
My question was, can I do that? See, I'm not running any servers or anything like that. Can I do that on a Windows Home machine myself?
Oh, yes. Yeah, go to CryptoPrevent.
I mean, the manual way. I did install one of my PCs.
Okay.
But I just to learn how to do it. Now, Brian was trying to go over with me. It was easy to use the Nix program. It does it all for you.
Right. Well, that'd be the, on a local machine that doesn't have it, that's, you don't have any access. You can get into the group policy on your local machine, but it's a lot of copying and pasting and editing out this file and that file and adding this file and that file. So it takes me a bit of time to do it manually.
Opposed
to just installing Nix product. So
you have to make a whitelist and you want to run.
You make a stuff that you don't want to run. So you disable.
Yeah, but there's stuff in there that you do want to run, right?
Right. And that's where we do that. Yeah. So here's a great example of that today. I have a client who needed to install Thunderbird on her local machine. So Friday she went and she tried to install it and it said this being blocked by group policy. So right. I know what's blocking this product. So this is kind of the easy way that I've just done it. It's fast and easy. Is it the right way? I don't know. What I do is I take the user out of that policy. That folder in group policy to actually move the computer out of it. Mm-hmm. Have them run gp update and then /force. That will refresh the group policy. Okay. You may or may not need to reboot. If it prompts you to reboot, you can just say no at that time. Run the application again. So then I had her click on Thunderbird and it installed just fine. Once it was done, I took her computer. I put it back in the group. I had her run gp update /force, which then refreshed the policy. And now she's back up and running. And so I just removed the policy from her machine and then added it back on there and was able to do that.
All right. So I ran Nix on my machine, my dual core upstairs laptop. So if I go and install something, am I going to have problems?
If it gives you a prompt that says this can't be installed, blocked by group policy, that's CryptoPrevent could be possibly blocking you from that.
Mm-hmm. Unless he has a list. I don't know how his program works. If he has a list on there that, this is okay, that's okay. I don't know.
There is a way to go in and whitelist stuff.
I think there's a thing in his program. I could add some.
Yeah, I believe there's also a way to open up. You can most likely, you can either have it create a shortcut on your desktop or on your start menu. You can click on the start menu, open the application. You usually have an undo, a test, and an apply button.
You can
hit undo, which will back everything out. You can reboot the computer, do what you need to do, open up CryptoPrevent again, hit apply, reboot the computer again, and now you've essentially done the same thing I did manually.
I got it. Okay.
Good job. So, but there are ways to whitelist things in there, but you have to know the name of what it is.
Right. Right. Syntax and all that.
Right. So maybe, to figure that out, maybe on, say, Thunderbird, I would have gone to the user's temp folder, had to run Thunderbird, look and see what it was actually running, maybe look at the date stamps and see what it was, now I was doing it via group policy, gone into the group policy, said, always allow this. Had our group do an update and try it again. The problem with that is that it's kind of, if I'm wrong, then it's like, okay, let's try this. Okay, let's try this. Okay, let's try this.
Right.
Where I know that if I removed her, had her install it, added her back into it, it would work.
Because they, I was in there, I think it's gpedit.msc, and Brian was walking. And it's also, they do have like a tutorial in the Windows and the thing. And I'm just looking at it a little bit, but it looked like it was a good bit to do.
On a group policy, it's not very hard. I've installed it, and now it's up to you whether or not, if you're a system administrator and if you only have four machines or five machines, you can just do it that way. But if they're on a domain, it really, whether you have five machines or 500 machines, it really makes it a whole lot easier to do it via group policy. Because as soon as you add a new computer, you just put it in the same OU, organizational unit, and then it gets those policies applied to it. And you don't have to worry about all of those, remembering all that stuff to do.
Right. I just thought I'd learn how to do something, but that might be easy for you, but I don't know. Nick's program was pretty easy to use, a lot easier.
Yeah, and I do know that they're in the works of doing some kind of a possibly like a D7 tutorial video series, mm-hmm. Maybe some training. So I've kind of heard through the grapevine that may be coming. Once that comes out, I will definitely bring it to the show because I know I'll be sitting in on it because I would like to learn how to use Nick's D7 and D7-2 more into the field here because I know that it can save me some time.
I tell you, I was looking up, tutorials on how to do this manually. But I tell you, most of the stuff on how to prevent, everything was going back to Nick's program, just about everything I researched, which is good for Nick.
Oh, yeah. So that computer behind me did find some viruses. So it took all the way until the end before it finally noticed some. So I'm glad it found some. I would hate for it to get all the way done and say, it's clean when I know it's not. That would stink. Did you ever use anything like Dyn DNS or DTDNS or any kind of those?
Yeah, I did I did it once a long time ago. Because what was I using? I forgot what I was using at the time. I guess one of the remote softwares. What's the free stuff that's out there? Everybody uses
like TeamViewer.
Not the TeamViewer, but the
VNC.
Yeah, like one of the VNC type things. And it did work for a while, but I never stayed with it or anything like that. I think it was free. What I was mm-hmm. doing was free, but I always had to update something, and I never, of course, I didn't use it after a while. But
right.
Yeah, it's the only thing I would mess around. And I think they had a paid version, too, where you didn't have to do anything.
Yeah, a lot of them are paid. I've had one for, oh my gosh, I don't even know if it's still around. It was DTDNS, and yeah, sure enough, it's still there. If you go to dtdns.com, you can see that it's pretty old. They've adjusted the copyright, but they've been around before, in the late 90s. And I used to use them for a long time.
Well, explain what this does. So
yeah,
I'm pretty sure I remember, but just in case I don't and other people.
Sure. So DNS, what DNS is it will translate, it's domain name services. It will translate your host name. So obandocomputing.com, if you go to www.obandocomputing.com, the computer, the web browser, everything knows how to get there because obandocomputing.com itself doesn't exist because you can't go to my server that way. You go to my IP address. But if I had you remember, 160.46.32.26, that would be for one web page. Now you remember now you got to remember those for Google and Facebook and Yahoo and, Podnuts. You can't do that. And there's no load balancing in that because Google has, if you look up Google's IP addresses, there are many of them. Okay. So you would have to remember all of Google's and then go down the list and find one that works for you if one was offline. So that's what DNS does. DNS will keep that record of obandocomputing.com points to here. That way, all you have to do is type in obandocomputing.com and you will get to my webpage. I change DNS whenever, if I was to move my server somewhere, I change DNS and that's how obandocomputing.com stops going from here and starts going there. Well, there are free programs out there, DTDNS, noip.com, and other ones. Dyn DNS is one that you've probably heard before. What those are for are if you need to get somewhere that has a dynamic IP address. So my server has a static IP address. It won't change. Okay. But at home, you may have a dynamic IP address, which means that every so often, it could be 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year and a half, whenever it decides that it's ready to do.
The IP address your cable providers provide.
Exactly. And that will, it's the IP address your cable provider provides or your DSL provider mm-hmm. or your internet provider, your ISP.
Right.
That chances are, unless you pay for a static IP address, you will get a dynamic IP address. And again, the time that it changes could be a long time to a short time. But if you need to get to your house sometimes, you may not know what your IP address is. You may have memorized it, but then, on a Monday, you go there and everything works fine because you've gone to 50.1.1.1. And now all of a sudden you get 69.4.3.2 on Tuesday. So you type in 50.1.1.1 and you can't get home anymore because your IP address has changed. So these companies come along and what you do is you either get a free one or you can pay for a service that will allow you to have an application that runs on your computer that checks and sees what your external IP address is, and then it synchronizes it with their servers. Now, you get a host name, and usually, and it could be whatever you want to call it, okay? For the longest time, I had obando.darktech.org. You could have obando.dtdns.com, or, you know, they will buy a whole bunch of domain names that sound kind of weird and sound a little bit odd. So you never know, you know, you can choose what they are.
He's home. Is that it? Is that your son?
Yeah, hold on.
Live. We're taking a little bit of pause. There's no problem. Everything's okay. And I'll talk about my phone real fast, my HTC One M8. It's good. It's doing quite well. It responds very quickly. I only have a few apps on here, which is like Voxer. What else do I have on here that I like to use a lot? I have my Google Voice, Facebook, and that's about it, really. I think of the extra apps that I put on. I think I only put 3 on in a week, but I'm quite satisfied. It's a big screen. Oh, sorry. I didn't know you were back.
No. I was just listening. It's only 3 in a week. Usually by that time, I've got mine hammered completely down.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't use a lot of stuff, you know. I'm going to probably put the speed test thing on there. I like that. But it's just, I just want to see how, you know, it works so far. And the camera, you know, it's only a 4-meg camera, but what they do on the HTC One is, I think most cameras, like the megapixels are like 1.2, 1.3, something like that, microns. And on this one, it's 2. They're bigger pixels, so you're going to get more light in. But a lot of people are knocking the camera and for that reason, because of the mega. But it's, you know, I just wanted something to take casual, decent pictures. It doesn't have to be great or whatever, because my other two Androids, the pictures were not really good at all. But you saw all the roses I took, and they were really good. They came out good. It's not like I'm going to print them or anything.
Well, they did come out good.
Yeah, and I'm really satisfied. I had some work done around the house over the weekend. A friend of mine trimmed some bushes for me, and I took some pictures of there, and it came out. You know, I'm satisfied with it so far. And I got a question for you.
Sure.
Because you get this, you know, app, iPhone versus Android all the time. You had both. Now,
I did.
Can you say you like one better than the other, or?
Well, my iPhone was an older iPhone. Mm-hmm. And my Galaxy S4 is a newer phone-ish. I mean, they have the 5 out now. And so I think the megapixel has come up. I'm not a photo guy, so
I'm just talking about in general. I mean, do you like one better than the other? I mean, you don't, not necessarily about picture taking, or is there, do you ever have any problems with crashing or?
No, I've never had any problems with that. I use as far as photography goes, I use just the basic camera, but then Android App Addicts, Door from Android App Addicts, a couple weeks ago, went through and talked about an application called Camera FV-5. It's a paid for app. They have a free one, but this one you can do, my goodness, this, you can adjust the aperture, you can adjust ISO, you can, I got it because it looked kind of cool. But really, it's way over my head. There's
It's just like a regular digital.
Yeah, I'm not a photo guy, so I bought it because I thought it would be kind of cool. And I realized, you know, it's kind of one of those things where you bought the Swiss Army knife, but really I just needed a corkscrew.
Right.
And I thought everything else would be fun, but then I realized that it's like, I don't even know what to do with some of this.
See, if I was serious about picture taking, I would buy a DSL, you know, a Nikon or Canon, because I got into it years and years ago, you know, with a 35mm, but you have to learn how to use it. I wanted something to take decent, casual pictures, which my two previous Androids weren't very good at. But this one is pretty good, and I think the Samsung, you know, even the S4 and the S5 are, you know, they're top of the line taking pictures, and this might be up there too now. This and the LG G2, but I'm satisfied. So, but I mean, cause I almost got the Samsung S5. It was between that and this, and I think there was more software bloat on that than I think they used TouchWiz or I'm getting mixed up. TouchWiz is their junk that they use, and I think this is called on HTC. It's called HTC Sense, I believe. Yeah. And That was, and it, plus I get, I think the S5 has 16 gigs of storage. This one has 32.
Oh, okay.
You know, it was, but there was, everything was so close. It was like 6 months ahead, and this was, I think, $50 cheaper. So.
Okay. Yeah. I just, so going back to, going back to that article, so if you have a home one, your IP address can change. So along comes these applications, and what they do is they will allow you to probably, most of them run an application, or you need to run an application somewhere locally on a computer in your network somewhere that will, and what it does is it just automates the task of telling the service that you have of either free or paid with what your external IP address is. That way, all you have to remember is, you know, obando.dtdns.org. Okay. And then no matter what happens, as long as you go to that, you will always be routed back to wherever, most likely your home, right? So I have been using, no IP for a while now. And a lot of my clients have. I have some clients who, there are some people who work offsite who need to get into the server. And so they, every now and then, but what'll happen is every now and then they call me and they just say, we can't get in. I was like, what? And so I'd go and I'd look, and sure enough, they can't get in because, especially no IP, the free one, it host names will expire every 30 days. So you have to go in and you have to set it up and you have to refresh it. And then it takes about 5 minutes to refresh. And so while I'm doing that, I'm waiting and they're waiting for me to call them back.
Yeah, that's a pain.
Finally, it refreshes and then I can call them back and say, you can get back in. And then I forget about it because then 30 days later, what happens is it does it again. And I go, oh, that's right. So no IP has the next level up is their enhanced DNS. It says more domain choices. Okay, so with a free one, you get up to three host names, and that's your Obando at DTDNS. So DTDNS is their host name. Maybe it's DyneDNS. Maybe it's Thunderdome.com. So whatever they provide, those are your host names that you can have. Okay, so they give you over 25 host names. They don't expire. Transfer or text records and wildcards, phone and email support, and some more features. And their more features are things like, oh, CNAME support, priority feature, multiple accounts, things like that. What I ended up doing was going ahead and, as Obando Computing, buying this, and it's $20 for the year. And you can give up to 25 host names. So what that means is then I was able to go to my clients who have who use noip.org or some kind of other some kind of DNS routing, and say, you know what? For this much money per month or for a year, maybe $3 a year. So for $3 a year, I can get you one that will just always stay on. Now I get a chance because they're my clients. I'm doing more of like a managed services. I can monitor, I can manage, I can maintain it. And one of my clients said, great, sounds good, let's do it, because these external clients were always having issues. Mm-hmm. So now they don't have to worry about that. They pay me just a little bit of money. I make just a little bit of money on it. Actually, I don't make any money because I'm using it. Now I'm going to start maybe reselling it out a little bit more. And now what happens is now they don't have to worry about updating it. I don't have to worry about getting a phone call from them saying they can't get in. If I'm busy doing something, then they have to wait for me to get a time to do it. And then I have to wait for the NoIP to update. This way it just is
done. So the pay version, you don't have to do that 30-day thing or?
No. Okay. No, and you get more, and you get more choices. And the choices were absolutely the choices were actually kind of insane of what the host names were. And I was really surprised. Some of them actually made me laugh. Let me look and see what I can find here as far as the host names were. So if I go in and I manage my hosts, or if I add a host, let's see. I'm going to add a host. Oh, let's see. Zapato.org. What were some of the, they have, oh, okay. So, I mean, just reading down it, blogstyle.com, collegefan.org, couchpotatofries.org, damserver.com. So we can have like geeksters at geeksters.damserver.com, eatingorganic.net, geekgalaxy, mlbfan.org, mymediapc.net. So that'd be a great one. So if you want to be able to access your media center remotely, mm-hmm. And you just need to be able to route to it all the time, you could be, Mitch.mymediapc.net, and it will always route. Now you could have Mitch.mymediapc.com, or what is it? Mymediapc.net. I could have Martin.mymediapc.net, and they're going to go two completely separate places.
All right, I have a good question for you.
Yeah. Right,
say I want to access one of my computers at home and from my phone. So the scenario that we're talking about now, what would I do? What's the best way to go about that? Just so I, like I can just access my PC at home, like I'm there, and then you know, browse.
Right. Right. So it depending on what you can do. So if you are if you purchase something like TeamViewer, and TeamViewer has a Android application, then there's nothing you need to do because TeamViewer will because you're using their proprietary software
to make a connection. Way, though, I would imagine.
It is. But so if you're using something like TeamViewer, you're using the TeamViewer application to make that connection, so you don't have to worry about making any IP address.
What, but if I use free VNC or something like that, it's a different
story. Right. Right, VNC, or if you just want to use your remote desktop terminal, the RDP protocol.
Yeah, for
real. So that would be where this would come in handy. So you could then, once you set this up and you run their little application on your computer and you have it running in the background, then you need to modify your router and do port forwarding. So it comes in on whatever port. I would recommend if you're going to do that, if you're going to do any kind of remote desktop protocol, which is over port 3389, change the listening IP or the listening port, and there are ways to do that. I'll see if I can add that to the show notes.
Yeah, okay.
But what you would do is because 3389 is the most popular port. That's the default one. So if you change it, it's not going to be. You're not making it more secure. You're kind of doing security through obscurity. If you make it 3390 or another whatever, what you're going to have to do though is you're going to have to change the listening port on your computer. You have to change the port forwarding for that particular port. And then when you use your RDP protocol, you have to tell it to go over the other port because by default it'll use 3389.
And I'm going to have to point it to the IP address of that computer too, right? The internal IP address of that computer.
Yes. So in your router, you would say port 33, 3090 or 3900. Internal, external goes to this IP address of this port.
It's been so long, and since I've done.
Yeah, you would do that. That was how you do some of the routing or the port forwarding on your router. But as far as you making a connection to your home, once that site is done, all you do is you just go to mitch.mypcmymediapc.net:3900 if you're choosing a different port that's non-standard. And then now it will always go to your 5.1.1.1 external IP address.
All right, here's another scenario, virtual private network. How different is that than what we're talking about to do the same thing?
So a VPN, you would definitely want to do something like this for a VPN because what you would do then is So VPN will make a connection from your external, where you are,
wherever,
to your home, and it will become part of that. So if you make that successful VPN connection, you can now remote terminal into your computer using its internal IP address because if you looked at your your network adapters, you will have two IP addresses. You will have your IP address. So say you're at Starbucks and maybe they're giving out a 10. IP address. So you may have from Starbucks a 10.1.1.100. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to use your VPN connection. You're going to get home. You're also going to get an IP address from home, and it may be a 192.168.1.100. Okay. So you have two IP addresses, one on your network adapter and one on your VPN adapter. So what happens is then if you say, I want to go to, and depending on how you set up your VPN, you can test all traffic through your home, which means that if you want to go to CNN.com, it will actually pass the traffic through the VPN to your home, out your router, out to the internet using your internet, and then back through and back to you. It will cause a delay, and it may slow things down a lot because you're passing everything through that. Usually what happens is it says, the software, I think there's some configurations that you can do. I don't know if it is on by default, but what will happen is it will say, I see that CNN.com is not at your home. Go out Starbucks internet. Now you say go to, you want to go to your router at home. You know, maybe you type in 192.168.1.1. It's going to say, that's at home. Go through the VPN tunnel. So it does separate it. So if you have a VPN, you are connecting to your home. Now you still may use your DTDNS or your noip.org IP address. Or name to connect to the VPN because what this all this no IP stuff is, it just creates a like DNS. It just creates a name pointer for you to get somewhere rather than having to use an IP address, whether that is using, you want a remote desktop to a computer, or whether you want to connect via VPN, or whether you want to do however you want to connect to that remote computer, you have to tell it where you want to go. This is just an easy way of remembering the name.
Very good. Very good. Good stuff.
And So I've been using noip.com. I bought their extended package and I've resold it to a couple clients, and I use it myself. So if I need to get home, I can just go to that. But I wanted to bring that up because it's something that I started to use and wanted to use it. And really, for a small business, it makes kind of an easy reselling tool, because they may, they may say, well, we want to get into our servers. And now, if you're using this for remote support, it's not very secure. If you're using a VPN tunnel, that's one thing. If you're using 3389 remote desktop protocol, that's not the most secure at all. Really, if you have to make some kind of secure connection back to another place, whether it's, if I'm just out and I need to get home for a reason, I'll use 3389. If I'm out and I need to get to a client, I will use another program. And that's where you have things like your Instant House Call, your Screen Connect, your TeamViewer, your LogMeIn. Those are all third-party applications that secure the traffic through them, because they're not going through port 3389. They're either going through port 80, which is already open, and they're encrypting the data through there. So that's if you're looking at a way of, I need to get back to my house, but I need to make secure, you can still use NoIP, but you may not want to use, remote desktop protocol. You may want to look at buying a third-party application, because those will be secure.
Okay. Interesting.
But this also works if you want to test something. So say you want to host something from your home, maybe you want to test out a server. When I first started with Screen Connect, I had it hosted in my home, and I would use this. I would point people to, obando.whatever.what, and it would go to that server, because I would reroute the traffic from, whatever port that was to my Screen Connect. And that's how I used it. Now I've moved Screen Connect off site and it has a static IP address. And then I iframed it with my web page and everything like that. So I don't need to use NoIP for that, because I already have a static IP. But if you want to test something, now if I ever want to test something, this is an easy way to test it.
Interesting. I used to play around with that. It's been so long and I forgot half of it, but it's been a long time.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, so today's the day, and I wish Tim was here, because he would get a kick out of this. Today is the day that if you are running Windows 8.1, you have to update to update 1. So I was doing some more reading on this, and this is from ZDNet, and this was actually sent to us by Aaron Turnbull, a good friend of Podnuts. And he sent me this one to remind me that if you're using Windows 8.1, you have to update to update 1. Or you will not get any more updates. Now, if you're using Windows 7 or just Windows 8, you will continue to get updates, but they are stopping updates for 8.1 unless you're on 8.1 update.
If you have automatic updates on already, aren't you getting all the updates?
The updates will not come through.
So you have to go to the their store to get the whatever it's called. Windows 8 thing to get the update, manually download it.
Right. So here, it's weird. Let me read you this article. It says, today, June 10th, is Microsoft Patch Tuesday. It's also the deadline for consumers running Windows 8.1 to install the 8.1 update if they want to continue receiving patches and fixes from Microsoft. Microsoft originally imposed, business users will still have, I'm kind of skimming through this. Consumers running 8.1 who have automatic updates turned on don't need to do anything. They should have already received the update automatically via Windows Update.
That's
by
what
now.
I'm talking about. Okay.
Yes. If you have updates turned on automatically, yes, and you're running Windows Update 8.1. Now 8.1 put the little toggle start menu switch in. So if you have that, if you go down and you click on that little, the new Windows icon, and you're not running something like Clash and Classic Shell or Start 8, things that have brought back the toolbar or the start menu as we have come to know it, then if you haven't installed those and you just hit that toggle and you toggle between the Metro interface and the tiled interface and the desktop, more than likely you probably have and are running Windows 8.1. And if you already have automatic updates turned on, you will get update 1. Okay. If you don't have that toggle switch, then you need to look. You can either leave it or see. I don't know if you're okay. Well, let me find
see, my
out.
My sister has Windows 8.
But if and, so, I'm curious if you don't have 8. Well, you probably what happens is if you have 8 and you update to 8.1, you then have to continue updating to 8.1 update 1. Because it says right here, users who are on Windows 8, not 8.1, are not subject to the requirement to move to 8.1 update by June 10th. Microsoft has set a January 2016 as the end support date for 8 for Windows 8 users who haven't moved to 8.1. Those running Windows 8 who are interested in moving to Windows 8.1 update do not need to move to Windows 8.1 first, as those updates are cumulative. There you go. So if you have 8, you can move to 8.1 update 1 without moving to 8.1 first. You staying with me?
No.
Okay.
All I know is she has auto updates on. And
right.
I talked to her the other day. Oh, it's running fine since I ran that malware bytes and cleaned all that stuff off.
So if you go, if you're on Windows 8 and you click on system, if you go into the system settings, you can look and see, I was thinking, and see what version of Windows you are running. So
that's right.
Anyways, update. So I get what they're saying.
I'm not running Windows 8, thank goodness.
Well, I'm not either, but a lot of people are running Windows 8 and probably listeners who are listening to us. I just want to recommend them and remind them that you need to go to 8.1 update 1 if you're running Windows 8.1. If you're running Windows 8, you will still get updates. But if you want to move to, you don't need to move.
Put it in the show notes.
Well, yeah, it's in the show notes. Anyways, there's an article by ZDNet. And it'll let you know. And like I said, I wish Tim was here because I remember last time we had this talk, he was laughing. He thought it was pretty funny. I had found this a couple weeks ago and I wanted to bring it up. I haven't done a whole lot of research on it, but it says that this is from Hacker News, the Hacker News. It says Google offers Chrome extension for end-to-end Gmail encryption. Have you heard anything about this? No.
I heard something about the other thing, the TrueCrypt is going to whatever.
Well, yeah, we may want to save that one for another day.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Because I followed about more about that because last week I did bring it up very briefly with Brian Lenduke. And we've gotten more information about it. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like that. Okay, remember a while ago, and I remember us talking about this, that Gmail will Gmail will scour your email for words and stuff for targeted ads.
Yes, they do.
Okay, so what's happening was because they could do that, therefore it was flawed. Now what it's saying is that you can put a new plugin called Safer Mail, and I have to go through this, but. Anyways, it's a plugin, and it sounds like you can do end-to-end sending and get some more information about it. And unfortunately, I mentioned it, I bring it up, and then I realize that I really don't have a whole lot of information on it. That's, my fault. But it looks like there is a plugin now for Google Chrome that will do some end-to-end encryption. And so check it out if you are interested in that. And I'm going to definitely check that out myself. I use Google Mail, but I'm curious if it's... What I'm curious about is if I send my Gmail account or a Gmail hosted account to you as your Gmail account, Mitch, I'm assuming that means that our encryption back and forth within Google to Google is encrypted. I do not believe that the encryption stays with me if I email from my Google account to an external site, because I believe it's using PGP and the receiver has to also have PGP back where Google is doing it automatically for you. And so you can turn that on. But like I said, what probably means then is that you can't be running Thunderbird or Outlook or some or a third-party application to get your email. You probably need to be using the webmail to be able to have this enabled because it's a plugin into Chrome. Because remember, when you're using a third-party app, you're writing it from your computer and you're sending it out, where if you log into the Chrome or the Google, you're actually writing it and distributing it from within their servers already.
Actually, I was just looking for it, as you say. Now they changed the interface again. That little store used to... Now I got to figure all this out again. Yeah, I'll check it out.
Yeah. We do have an email. And this is from Gary at grcomputerrepair.net, and I believe he's from London. He opens it up and he says, "G'day." He says, "G'day, Martin, Mitch, Tim, and PC Freddy."
That was Australia. Sorry for the interruption.
Well, no, I know that, but I went to his computer. I thought that too, and so I went to his site, and on his site he says, "My name is Gary, and welcome to GR Computer Repair. I've been repairing laptops, desktops for over 10 years in the Liverpool, Fairfield area."
Right.
So he says he's registered with the Department of NSW, which I thought was New South Wales Fair Trading. Oh, no, it's Australia. Yeah, you're right. It is registered with Australia. So he is Australian.
Good day.
Good day. Okay, back to the email. "Good day, Martin, Mitch, Tim, and PC Freddy. Just a net note to say how much I enjoy your shows. I live in Australia." Well, there it is. If I would have continued on.
I can't remember.
"I live in Australia. Find it hard to watch you guys live. I download them and listen to them when I can. I run a part-time computer repair business servicing both residential and small business or small contractors in the western suburbs of Sydney." Now we're even. I'm sorry, Gary. I was completely wrong where you lived. Okay.
It helps when you read the email.
It does help. "Recently in my spare time, I've dabbled in installations of XMBC Media Center on Windows 7 machines and have loved it so much that I have canceled my Foxtel subscription. XMBC is saving me heaps of money. I just wanted to know whether any of you guys have had an experience with XMBC Media Center. To Mitch, I hope all goes well with your eye surgery and that you have a quick recovery. Thanks again, guys, for all the time you put in putting the show together. Kind regards, Gary."
That's very nice.
That was very nice.
So Dora might have some experience with that. I have not.
You haven't?
No, but Dora has.
I've had experience with RaspBMC and OpenELEC. And the only reason I have experience with those is because the last time I had a computer hooked up to my TV for a media center, it was actually running the Windows XP version of Media Center or the Vista version of Media Center. And then after that, what it was is it just kind of became, that kind of became old and kind of in the way. And so I got rid of that and I ended up hooking up just a computer to it. And then just basically using a mouse. So it was just, my TV became a big monitor. That's what happened.
Same thing with me. I mean, I have a Roku, Google Chrome, and I don't use it. You know, I got it once, you know, I use it a little bit, but I have my PC that I use most of the time, a laptop upstairs, is hooked to my HDTV, and I use it on there most of the time. So
yeah. When I got my Raspberry Pi, though, I did start doing more with the Media Center. Yeah. And since I've moved, I haven't done anything with it. So I started using RaspBMC, which is the XMBC or XBMC version within Raspberry Pi. So it's a kind of a modified version. And honestly, I couldn't get it to work right. I was having some serious network issues with it, and I think they've adjusted it and made some changes to it. I just haven't had a chance to get back to it. So I had started using OpenELEC and was using that along for quite a while. But whether it's OpenELEC or RaspBMC or XMBC, we're still talking Media Center. And I have had experience with it. I like it because I can get an application. Maybe you have a NAS, and maybe instead of having DVDs going in and out of machine and getting scratched and stuff like that, you can just rip them, make them MP4s, put them on your Media Center, your NAS, point your Media Center, RaspBMC, OpenELEC, XMBC right to your NAS, and then you can just watch them right from there. And it makes it really simple. They all have new interfaces now where they go out to the internet and they get updates, and you can look at trailers and you can get synopsis and you can get titles and covers and screen things, and they can interface with IMDb. It's really, really cool. And Plex is another big one that a lot of people use.
But that's a service, though.
That one you do have to pay for. I know that one of the gentlemen from Everyday Linux, I know it's not Mark, so it's either Seth or Chris. Is it Chris?
I don't know. I've heard other people talking about it lately.
Right. So one of those guys from the Everyday Linux show uses Plex and is a big Plex supporter. He has been using it for years and years and years and loves it. I've never used it, so I don't have any experience with it. But I do like the fact that we have these chances for media centers to be able to use, so we can have our own data. And if it's, a YouTube video or something like that. But you did bring up a good point, Mitch, with Roku boxes now and Google Chromecast.
Yeah, they're so easy, we like to mess around with stuff like that, because it's geeky, I guess. But I have my Sony Blu-ray player. It's got the smart apps in there, and I can put take a USB thumb drive, whatever, and I have that filled up with movies, and it just plays an MP4 right there. I don't have to convert them over or anything. It plays fine.
Yeah, I'm a screen cutter just like you, Gary. Cable cutter. I don't have cable. I shouldn't say that because I do have cable. But really, we were watching one show and the show has ended. So I turn on cable and I just kind of flip through the channels. I was in my in-laws' house this weekend and I sat down to watch some TV and I realized I would spend 5 to 7 minutes surfing all the channels. They have Dish, looking at all the channels. And I think I looked at all of them 4 times thinking, by magic, I hope something changed and I will be able to watch something that interests me. And I ended up just turning it off and listening to podcasts because I found it awfully boring.
Well, I got to tell you, because I have Comcast and I got everything through on my phone, internet and TV, and I am getting 4 premium channels. I have been watching a lot of the series, like old series that's been on. I just started watching Oz last night. I don't know if you're familiar with that about this prison. That was it in 96 it started, 98. Yeah, I started watching an episode of that. It was pretty good. I watched The Wire. That was from, I think, started in 2002. It was on for 5 years. Watched all that in a week or two. But I'm paying for it. It's on demand on Comcast. So I haven't been renting anything at the, Redbox in the last probably 2 months. Because, my wife said, we're paying all this money. Let's start watching stuff. And,
right.
It's convenient. But it is a lot of money. I mean, what we're right. paying for, like $180-some with the 4 premium channels and internet and TV. But
yeah, I'm a Redbox fan myself. And the other day we rented some movies and ended up holding them onto a week. And
it's so, yes, but
$1.20.
That's right. You're right.
So we have, I don't have a Roku box, but I have a PlayStation, Xbox 360. And that is our Hulu and Netflix and Crackle and Amazon Prime. And so really, that's what we watch, and I really need to get my media center back up and running because I do have some movies on there that I would really like to watch, but I can't watch them. So I'll watch them, on my tablet or my phone or something like that. So I do have experience with it. I love the media centers. I think they're getting much better every day. They're coming out with new stuff. And so I agree, Gary. I love it too.
See, I like now the Roku. What I didn't like, it didn't have Chrome on there. I'm not Chrome. Google, YouTube rather. And then there was a way you could get it, and then it was gone again. Now I'm hearing they have it back up there, that they put it up there. I don't know. We'll see. I haven't plugged it in my Roku up in about a year, probably. But then I got to get the Chromecast, too. I'll take care of that. Because I would watch YouTube more than anything, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Because, you see some shows on there or how-tos. And
those or cat or cat videos.
What videos? What?
Cat videos.
I'm a dog man. You know that.
Oh, I'm sorry. My bad. Okay, dog videos.
You're right.
But I even had a client today. She had an iPad. She had an iPad. She was traveling. She goes to her son. Her son is the stand-in for Dwayne Johnson in his movies. He's his stunt double, actually.
You're talking about the Rock, right?
The Rock, right. So her son is his stunt double. Really? I thought that was kind of cool. Anyway, she has an iPad, and she was in Hawaii because her son lives in Hawaii, and she was in there, and she was using the Netflix free 30-day trial, and she came home and she canceled it because she was having some stuttering issue, and I think it was a buffering issue with her wireless. But besides the point, she's thinking about getting, watching Netflix. She liked it and was thinking about getting it for her TV. Now, she has an older TV. I don't think it has I think it's going to just have the RCA jacks. I don't think it's going to have HDMI or anything like that. Yeah. So you have to go with the original Roku box, which you can still find. But I think she was under the impression until we got talking about it that she would have to buy a Netflix subscription for her TV and a Netflix subscription for her phone and then a Netflix subscription for her. And I said, no. Yeah. And I told her that. And she said, really? And so she was very surprised that she could get one subscription for all of them. And I told her the same thing for Hulu and Amazon Prime. And she said, and you could kind of see her say, well, that may have sealed the deal. And I told her, let me know. I can come. We can get you a Roku box and we'll get you all set up. So I think she's going to go that way now that she knows that she can sit at home and watch Netflix. She can take the tablet with her and watch Netflix and not have to pay dual. Because I think that was kind of a deciding factor that she was going to be against it.
What scares me, because I don't have Netflix. I mean, I belonged to them before they did the streaming thing. And it's a net neutrality thing. I know that Comcast did their, they paid Comcast, but
yeah,
I just don't think that thing's going to end anytime. You're going to have all kinds of problems. I mean, what if you get it and you're going to, oh man, it's buffering and, you know, and you know that I'm paying, I'm getting the highest speed. I'm getting 90 some down, you know, and I just worry about all that stuff because there is good programming on Netflix, original program. I would love to see, but.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. I hear you. We'll have to just see. Well, who knows where the net neutrality is going? Last week, I was talking with Brian Lenduk. We talked about it, and there's some show notes for about net neutrality, and we'll have to see what happens with it.
Mm-hmm. Go from there. Because, I mean, before I got into computers, I used to fish all the time. I can easily go back into that.
Now, is that like fishing, like scam artists, or is that like
freshwater fishing? I had two different boats, yeah, mainly bass fishing, and I think I've done it once since 90. When did I get my computers? 96. I think I've only went fishing once or twice since then. That's terrible. Oh. And I used to go every weekend, and maybe once during a week.
Well, then you could always use the famous joke. You could people say, "Mitch, what are you fishing for?" And you could say, "For the halibut."
Yeah.
No. All right. So one more thing I wanted to let everybody know is that if you go to podnuts.com, up in the top, very top, big banner, can't miss it, there's a Take This Survey. And the survey will let us know what you, the listeners, are listening to, watching. What are you guys interested to? How often do you listen to the shows? What shows do you listen to? It kind of gives us a feel as hosts, as part of the Podnuts Network. What are you guys interested in? Are we providing you, which would do a couple things. One, it's going to let us know what you guys are interested in, what you're not interested in, and then what can we do to make what you are interested in even better, you know? And so it takes like 5-7 minutes. It's easy. It's not a test. There's no pressure. Just have fun. Grab a nice beer. Sit down. Take the Podnuts survey. We'd really appreciate that as hosts. I know Dora would appreciate that. And that gives us a chance to maybe even tailor what the Podnuts Network will look like to suit you guys better, to give you what you're interested in. I would appreciate that. And I know I don't know if Mitch would appreciate it. I would.
No.
But if you guys could go take the survey, that would be that would help us out a lot.
I want to, and we talked about it before, but having Jeff Hallish, I hope I'm saying his name right. I tell you, he's amazing. I mean, what he's doing for this network. I mean, it's just, all the shows are great that he does. All his interviews. I can't say speak enough for the guy.
Yeah, and I know that
he's true green, whatever that color is.
He's. And he is he's taken off with that. And the other thing that I also have really enjoyed is the new, sometimes I travel, but sometimes it's a little here, a little there, a little here, a little there. It's some days I'm in the car a lot, and those are great days because I can listen to a lot of podcasts. And there are other days when I am in the car a little bit, and that's when I really need the shorter, smaller podcasts. And I really like the way for me that Android App Addicts has really changed their format and their thing. So if you guys have never listened to Android Epics, we've talked about, you know, Mitch, you were talking about your phone. You got the new phone. I have an Android phone. A lot of people do. Check out the new Android App Addicts. They've shortened it down. It's a daily show now. It's tiny. It's quick. You can listen to it when you're just on the way to the bus stop or in the van, or it's just in the car on your way to your job. Really, really, really short. And they've done a really good job with it. And they have had guests on there. I think Cody was on there for a while, and they had another gentleman on. They had the producer or the owner of FiveBy, which is the video streaming thing on there for a while. So if you haven't heard the new Android App Addicts, check it out. If you want to send an email in like Gary has, Mitch, where can they do that?
Well, you can send an email at geesters@podnuts.com. You can voicemail us at 7076-PODNUT, 7076-PODNUT. We haven't had any in a while. I might have to call.
Disguise your voice.
Oh, yeah, which is easy to do for me.
Okay.
Come on. Email us and send us a voicemail, please. Please. Yeah,
we do like getting those. We like knowing that you guys are listening. We like hearing success stories and failure stories and questions. And because I bring my success stories. I bring my failure stories to you guys. We like hearing what you guys are going through and what we can do to help you out. But if you guys want to get a hold of me, martin@obandocomputing.com. I'm Maskill in the forums, Maskill in the chat room. You can find me at I'm Martin Obando or M Obando on Google Plus. I'm there. You guys can just look me up and we can talk and chat and get together and have a good time. So, I think that's a good one, Mike. I think
good show.
Yeah, I think it's a good show. Good show.
I'm a sidekick, so. But I'm just a listener because you entertain me, Martin. You always do.
Well, I kind of come with some song and dance. All right, Mitch, thanks for coming out and hanging out with me today. And everybody who's listening, everybody who hasn't listened to us yet, and I'm talking to you guys in the future. Have a great fiscal week, and we'll see you later. Bye-bye.
D72 is here. Go to foolishit.com for more information.